Let me just remind you, if you have forgotten, that we're in the middle of a series on Nehemiah. And the context is, if you remember, that Nehemiah, an official in the court of the king in Persia, has been distressed to hear about the state of Jerusalem. He's asked permission to go back home and to begin this project to rebuild the city walls. The whole infrastructure of the nation of Judah is in a complete mess. And he is stuck right in with trying to rebuild everything. And they face very significant local opposition to this, because obviously it's to the advantage of the surrounding nations if the infrastructure is completely chaotic after the years that the people of Judah were in exile. That had happened quite a while before, of course, and it had happened because of the people's idolatry, because of their unfaithfulness to God. And so they'd endured 70 years where the majority of their population had been in exile, just a small number left. Some have returned from exile, but it's nothing like what it had been. Small numbers of people, very difficult situations, and Nehemiah is determined, even despite the opposition that we were thinking about last week, to rebuild it all. And so, as we've said several times during this series, this is a building site at more than one level. It's a building site because Nehemiah is building a wall, but more than that, he's building a community of God's people working together. And it's rebuilding the people of God and giving them a sense of togetherness and of being the people of God in contrast to these pagan nations around them. That is, in many ways, Nehemiah's primary focus. But now, both building projects are under threat again. But this time, it's threats from within the community, not, as we were thinking about last time, threats from outside. And as we'll think about again next week, more threats from outside. But here, in the middle of this building, suddenly there are issues going on within the community that threaten to derail the whole thing. And it's often the way, isn't it? You think that you've dealt with all of the external threats and what's going on around you, as Nehemiah has done in chapter 5. And then suddenly you discover that the team itself, or the church, is beginning to fall apart at the seams. And so Nehemiah has got a big issue on his hands. But life in Judah was already tough. As I say, the infrastructure was in ruins, and things were very difficult for them in these days. And then they've got this period of, not very long period, admittedly, but just over 7 weeks, when the whole of the people are hard at work by families and in different trade groups and whatever, rebuilding the walls. And they're working flat out together to rebuild these walls. And what's happened is that the added pressure of this in an already difficult situation is that it's brought all kinds of ongoing, simmering problems up to the surface, and they've become major issues. As I say, they were experiencing hard times already, partly because there was a famine going on, and obviously that always puts the pressure on. And also they were facing very significant economic hardship. The two of those are related. But the economic hardship was particularly a result of three things. Taxes. The king of Persia demanded very high levels of tax. They were experiencing inflation, and they were having to contend with high interest loans. Just kind of a 21st century story, isn't it? We just don't have to contend with the famine in Britain at the moment. Now, these taxes, the king of Persia, he did kind of rake it in on the tax front. 20 million darics a year, which on Friday's prices works out at about £1.8 billion a year, which is a fairly significant income for an empire in the Middle East in that kind of time, one imagines. I mean, £1.8 billion is our prices, obviously. But so he's raking all of this lot in. And Alexander, when he captured Susa, the citadel of Susa, he found 270 tons of gold and 1,200 tons of silver, which had been melted down and stored as bullion. That's just in Susa, and there were five other royal cities. And that's causing a problem, because the taxes are paid in coins, but they're then melted down into bullion, and those coins are taken out of circulation. And my economist friends tell me that if you take the currency out of circulation, so there's less currency actually going on, you know, for people to use, that fuels inflation. And so one of the reasons why they're experiencing inflation is because of this. There are other factors going on there as well, one or two that we'll consider in a moment. But some historical sources suggest that they were experiencing inflation of about 50% a year, something like that, which is significantly higher than we're having to deal with. And so many people found themselves in a situation where, in order to pay the tax, they had to mortgage their land. But because the situation was so difficult anyway, there was never any prospect of them being able to redeem that land. So they mortgage it, and then it's gone from their family forever. And eventually, sooner or later, they'll have to start paying rent on it, one imagines. So in the middle of that context, these kind of simmering issues of tax and economic difficulties and famine, they all come to the surface, and the criticism gets levelled at Nehemiah. Nehemiah's the guy in charge. He's making us do this building project. He can jolly well sort it out. What's interesting is that the complaints don't just come through the kind of the official channels. It's not the heads of the families having a, you know, bringing a deputation to Nehemiah and saying, "Listen, old chap, we've got stuff to sort out." It's everybody. It's the wives as well coming and saying, "We cannot afford to feed our children. What are we going to do? How can we carry on building this wall when we can't even buy grain in order to eat and survive?" So there's an outcry, but shockingly, this outcry is against their fellow Israelites. Because while there are these external things going on, the core problem, the thing that was really making it so serious, was the fact that it was Jews, people within the community, people with power and wealth, the nobles and officials, we're told, or some of them, who were exploiting others and creating the situation. At the very time when all the people of God are supposedly pulling together, rebuilding the wall, everybody with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other, and they're all mucking in, there's records of one guy's daughters who were building a section of wall and so on. These guys are just exploiting the poor to the point where they can barely survive. So, yes, there's famine, yes, there's economic hardship, and those are kind of things that you've just got to put up with in that kind of situation. But why then, of all times, should the rich get richer at the expense of the poor? So as we see in the first few verses of chapter 5, it's a very serious crisis. Verse 2, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." So clearly they're short of food. Verse 3 is about people mortgaging their fields in order to get food. Others are borrowing money in order to pay the tax on the fields and vineyards. And then the most shocking of all in verse 5, "Although we are of the same flesh and blood as the rest of our people, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery." Which strikes me as being a wonderfully good idea. If anybody wants to make an offer for one of these, they've got loads of potential. They're all very well trained and so on. No? Okay. The thing is, slavery should never have happened. They should never have been in this kind of situation. The law of Moses, Leviticus 25, makes very clear that if somebody is in a complete financial mess, what they can do is offer themselves as an indentured servant, a bond slave to somebody for a period of time. And what that means is that they would go and work for some local wealthy person who would provide their food and their lodgings and maybe a small amount of money. And until such time as their financial situation was sorted out, or until the year of Jubilee came, in which case they were to be released and sent home again with their family. And so they could work on that kind of basis, but it's very clear that they were not becoming slaves. They were to be treated in every way as hired servants. And this was an act of kindness and compassion on the part of the wealthy people. Obviously, they got something out of it as well. They got some labour, some fairly cheap labour, but it was helping this person who had become poor. And never were Israelites to be sold as slaves to the Gentiles. The reason given is that you are servants of God, and therefore how can you ever be slaves of other people who do not worship God? So slavery shouldn't have happened. Yes, some of these people could have become indentured servants, but they were never to have become slaves. And so Nehemiah's response to what he's hearing is very serious. He takes the charges very seriously. He's an impressive man because every point throughout this story, from beginning to end, when a problem arises, he just meets it head on. He is not like me and dithers and procrastinates and hopes that if I wait long enough, the problem will go away. He just says, right, let's deal with it. And whether that's some external problem that's got to be dealt with or whether it's crisis within the community itself, he tackles it straight away. He doesn't let this dissatisfaction fester. He nips it in the bud and tries to find a way forward so that all of these people, the exploiters and the exploited, could once more be all part of the people of God working together as a community. So Nehemiah's complaints department is not like this. You can see that. He's not the kind of complaints department that you turn up and it's on your own head, be it, if you dare to voice any complaints. He takes his problems seriously. So he's angry at the injustice. We see that in verse 6. He says he was very angry. And he summons the officials and the nobles to give an account of themselves. So he confronts them. And he makes his accusations. Firstly, you're charging interest. It was expressed as usury in the Bibles we've got in the pews. I'll come back to that in a moment. It's not usury as we tend to think of it these days. But they were charging interest and they were selling their fellow Jews, only for them to be bought back again. The crazy thing is that in the middle of this difficult economic situation, clearly what they were trying to do was to buy back Jews who had already been sold into slavery. Reasoning quite correctly that it is a disgrace for the people of God to be enslaved by pagans round about us. So they're busy doing their best to buy these people back. And yet people within their own community, their own leaders, are selling others on so that they can be bought back again. Presumably paying a higher price than they were sold for in the first place. So it's just compounding the whole situation. What's interesting here is that Nehemiah first summons the officials and nobles, and then he calls together a large meeting. So he actually deals with this in a very public way as well, to make sure that this is dealt with. You see that in verse 7. I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, blah, blah, blah. Now, this business about usury and interest. We think of usury as being extortionate levels of interest, the kind of levels of interest that are put on store cards and such like, 20% per annum and so on. That's what we think of as usury these days. It's not about exorbitant interest in the Old Testament, no. It's about interest full stop. The requirement on the people of God was not to charge interest to other Israelites. You could charge interest to people from other countries, but not to people from within Israel. There's a little bit of ambiguity about this in some places. For instance, you've got Ezekiel 18, where the problem is taking excessive interest. Ezekiel's saying a righteous man doesn't take excessive interest, or let the usury. But the requirement in Deuteronomy is not to be charging interest at all. The thing is, the interest only compounds the problem, doesn't it? If you've got an economically difficult situation, the poor people are having to pay interest on their loans, that intensifies the seriousness of their situation. And what a landowner, somebody wealthy who is offering these loans to poor people, he can say, I'm such a kind man and you're helping all these people and giving out loans all over the place. But because he's charging interest, he's actually making a profit on it. He's not helping these people, he's making their situation worse. The poor are the ones who most need the loans in times of difficulty, but of course they're the ones who can least afford it. I remember in my first year on staff with UCCF, having just finished teaching, I had a complete financial crisis. And I had to have some expenditure on my flat, credit card bills, and suddenly with my UCCF salary, I couldn't really afford to pay this. And so I kept being hit by bank charges because I didn't have the money. I'd go slightly overdrawn and I'd be hit with fine, after, you know, charges after charges. And it just felt, this is exacerbating the problem. How am I ever going to see an end to this situation? It's a familiar story in our society, a familiar story in our world altogether. The rich profiting at the expense of the helpless. It applies at an international level. We Western nations have grown rich at the expense of developing nations. Last year was the year of Make Poverty History, the year that we wanted to deal with global poverty once and for all. The year when the rich West, we hoped, was going to cancel all those debt repayments from third world nations that cannot afford to pay them. But it didn't happen. It helped, but we didn't deal with the problem sufficiently well. There are still nations that have got to pay such massive interest payments to the West that there is no prospect of them ever sorting out their infrastructure. It's a complex problem. There are all kinds of other things going on as well. But nevertheless, we rich Western nations are exploiting the poor of our world. And we rich Western citizens are part of it. Here's God's verdict on exploitation. Here is Isaiah condemning those people who, by being wealthy and just taking over poor people's property and lives, they add house to house and join field to field until no space is left, and you live alone in the land. You actually wreck the community altogether. Or a few chapters on, woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. God says this is a disgrace. Because you should know, reasons Isaiah, what God's heart is for the poor and the disadvantaged and the oppressed and the widow and the fatherless. You should be helping these people, not exploiting them. Or Jeremiah, just in the very beginning of the exile, or just before it, talking about King Jehoahaz. Woe to him who builds his palace by unrighteousness, his upper rooms by injustice, making his countrymen work for nothing, slavery within Israel, not paying them for their labour. Does it make you a king to have more and more cedar? Didn't your father Josiah the reformer, have food and drink? He did what was right and just. So all went well with him. He defended the cause of the poor and needy, and so all went well. Is that not what it means to know me? Declares the Lord. Now, in the evangelical churches, we can very easily talk a lot about knowing God, and it's all about our relationship with God through Jesus Christ, our faith in Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection. And rightly so, that is the very centre and heart of our faith as we've been celebrating this morning. Everything pivots around what we have celebrated, Jesus' death and resurrection. But to be people of God, to be God's children, to know God, has certain implications for the rest of our lives. In particular, in this context, it means there are implications for the way that we relate to other people within the family of God, within our community, and within our world. Because if we claim to know God, we should be like God. We should be reflecting something of his character. And if God is concerned for the poor and the needy, so should we be. Yes, the church in Britain got itself into a complete mess when it emphasised the social gospel, only talking about the needs of society and dealing with these kinds of problems, and stopped talking about the heart of our faith, faith in Jesus Christ. But to say that they got that wrong because they abandoned the gospel and just talked about society doesn't mean that we're right not to be concerned about these issues. We have to have both at the same time. The Bible insists that if we know God, we are to be concerned for our world as well as our spiritual state before God. The two are bound up with each other. And so in Nehemiah's view, injustice like this stinks. He says in verse 9 to these people, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? Two aspects there that are motivating: fear of God and avoiding reproach in the eyes of those people who are not believers. That first idea is picked up in Proverbs 14, among other places. He who oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker. But whoever is kind to the needy honours God. We may think, well, we never oppress the poor. That's not. We don't do that. Don't we? Aren't we actually implicated in the whole Western system of exploiting third world nations? Fifteen years ago, I suppose, I was down in the south of Brazil and met a tea farmer who was being paid 1 cent per kilogram for his tea. And it was being sold at, oh my goodness knows what price it was being sold 15 years ago. But it was seeing this guy struggling to make a living, selling tea to the West that was going to be sold at inflated prices. Who's making the money? Not the guy with the tea plantation. It's the guys in their swanky offices. And the marketing people. It matters what we buy. It matters what kind of lifestyle we live, because it impacts on other people. Maybe only in, we can only do a small bit. But a lot of people doing small bits actually adds up. Are we kind to the needy? It's alright saying we're not oppressing the poor, but are we actually actively kind to the needy? Or 1 Peter 2 picks up the other aspect. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. We need to press on, we're running out of time. So should we care about injustice? Yes. Half the world's population live on less than $2 a day. 33,000 children still die every day as a result of poverty. Well, how about this? This is a figure from UNICEF. 1.2 million children are sold as cheap labour or into the sex industry every year. Next year we celebrate the anniversary of the abolition of slavery. That's a bit of a joke, isn't it? When a couple of thousand people are sold into slavery in Britain every year, people trafficked across borders into our country to work as sex slaves. How can we just sit in our cozy little middle class worlds and not be concerned about this kind of issue? There are possibly 10 times as many people as that, when you include adults as well, who are being trafficked. It is a disgrace that such things should go on in our world. And we have got to be concerned. The real problem is not the trade or the lending of money. It's not making a profit. Such things are important. They're vital. The problem is the greed that leads to exploiting the poor and the helpless. And it's very easy to point to the greed of our Western nations that's exploiting people. And by doing so, to avoid the fact that we too can be caught up in this. We too can be greedy and self-promoting and end up exploiting others. We may not be exploiting poor people directly, but we can exploit people in other ways. We can take advantage of their kindness. Or we can just constantly be making demands of people. Or we can be taking advantage of people in terms of getting ourselves to the top of the pile, even in the church. There are all kinds of ways in which we can be self-promoting. And as far as Nehemiah is concerned, all of that must stop. Now, he takes a great pains to make sure that change actually happens. The nobles and officials have got no answer to the charges in verse 8. They're absolutely silent. They know they're guilty. And they respond to their credit very positively to Nehemiah's challenge. But Nehemiah isn't just going to let them say, yes, yes, we'll do it, and then nothing change. He wants a contract. So they have to do it on oath. He wants it in writing so that everybody's clear what has been agreed. And as I say, this appears to be in a public meeting. So he's really following through. And then he talks a bit about his own example in verses 14 to 19. He's been made governor of Judah. He served for 12 years in his first period as governor. And as such, he was allowed to tax people and to requisition supplies in order to fund his governor lifestyle. But he refused to exercise his rights, just as Paul did in the New Testament. Didn't expect the churches to support him, but raised his own support through tent making. Nehemiah does the same kind of thing. Now, he had a responsibility as the governor to entertain lavishly. That was expected in the ancient world in the Middle East. It still is in the Middle East in many ways. And so we're told that he provides dinner for 150 Jews and officials, plus visitors from surrounding nations, plus his own staff and his own men, and the guard that the king of Persia had given him. And the provisions that are here probably are enough to feed 600 or more people. But he is not funding that by requisitioning supplies and by taxing people. He's setting the example and saying, "Now I'll pay this myself. We're in an economic mess here. I have to, this is my duty as governor. Let me feed some people and do it out of my own pocket rather than making life worse for those who are poor and disadvantaged." His motivation and his character are crucial in all of this. We see a number of aspects. Firstly, his reverence for God. That should be verse 15, not verse 16. "Out of reverence for God, I did not act like earlier governors who placed a heavy burden on people, or like the previous governor's assistants who lorded it over people. Out of reverence for God, I did not act like that." The way we behave to God, our attitude to God, affects the way we behave with other people. How can we claim to be God's servants and to lord it over other people? How can we claim to be solely dependent on God's grace and not act with grace towards others? And so that works in Nehemiah's life in terms of his humility, his devotion to the work God has given him, and his generosity. And then again in verse 19, it's clear that his primary motivation, the thing he is most concerned about above everything else, is wanting to please God alone. How do we do on those things? How does our reverence for God, our claimed reverence for God, actually work out in our lives? Do we act with humility? Are we devoted to the work God has given us, whether we like it or not? Are we generous? Do we want to please God alone? Are we angry about injustice? Do we care about the state of God's world? Are we prepared to forego our rights and our privileges in order to help other people? Are we devoted to the work we've got to do? Do we really want to please God? Nehemiah's character is an anticipation of the character of Christ in some ways. The attitude that should characterize every child of God. Your attitude should be the same that Christ Jesus had. Though he was God, he did not demand and cling to his rights as God. He made himself nothing. He took the humble position of a slave and appeared in human form. And in human form, he obediently humbled himself even further by dying a criminal's death on a cross. Because of this, God raised him up to the heights of heaven and gave him a name that is above every name. So that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. We sang that earlier on. But it's Jesus' attitude of humility and obedience in order to win lost people, in order to bring grace into the world, that Paul says should be our attitude too. Nehemiah is a great example of servant leadership, and one that we need to heed.